working in a car, and the car won't go. That's the way you spell Chicago. Knife and a fork and a plate of green. That's the way you spell New Orleans. Hey, little girl, in the tight, tight sweater. Hey, baby, sure looking mellow. The girl over there with the hot pants on, turn her loose, Jane Brown, let her turn me on. It's me and you, baby, go hand in hand. You the bow-legged woman, and I'm a knock-kneed man. In my room, a boom, 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 boom. In my room, boom, 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 boom. Make love to you. Make love to you. All I wanna do is make love to you. In my room, me and you. In my room, in my room, in my room.
Oh, DePose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Well, the economic situation in the United States has taken a very interesting turn, and in particular, if you believe, as I believe the evidence shows, that one of the greatest indicators as to how a particular election is going to go is the perception of how the economy is doing. Things are all of a sudden looking quite okay for Democrats and not so good for Republicans if the average person actually understands what's going on. And I want to start by looking at the first interesting indicator for today, and that is gas prices. Gas prices have now continued to fall for nearly 60 days in a row and are below $4 per gallon for the first time since March of 2022. Now, why are gas prices so important? Because is gasoline really a major expense for most households? And the answer is not directly. Certainly, if you're in transportation, Uber drivers, et cetera, it's a major thing. If you have a long commute, it's a major thing. But there's two reasons why this is important. Number one, many people look at gas prices as a general proxy towards are things cheaper, expensive right now. And when gas is $5.02 per gallon, as it was 2 months ago, there is the perception that things are generally expensive. And when gas now drops below $4 a gallon, there's the perception that things are cheaper. We know things are cheaper because inflation has started to come down. But there's another issue with gas prices, which is so many of the things that we depend on, food, products of different kinds, so many different things, they come on trucks and are affected by gas prices as well. So this is an important indicator for that reason. And when we look at the Gas Buddy price charts, you will see that there was this peak at about $5.02 per gallon late in, early in June. And then it has been a continued and steady decline, now below $4 per gallon to what looks like, let me see officially what CNN says, $3.99 per gallon as of this morning, according to AAA. So let's now take a deeper look at some of these economic indicators. If you step back and you think about over the last 2 weeks, what have we seen? Well, we've seen the stock market increase nicely. We've seen a blockbuster jobs report where 250,000 jobs were expected in July, and we got over 500,000 jobs, more than doubling the expectation. Inflation is down. Gas prices are down. The Inflation Reduction Act has been signed. The Inflation Reduction Act has been approved by the Senate. And then tomorrow, presumably, will be approved by the House and very quickly signed by Joe Biden. The PACT Act has been signed. Wages are up. And then on the other hand, you have Donald Trump raided by the FBI with pictures of his toilet with documents in it circulating as he pled the fifth yesterday more than 400 times when deposed by the New York Attorney General. Things aren't looking very good for Trump world, and things are looking increasingly good for Joe Biden now. Is it good that gas prices are low? One of the things that we have to understand is that it's not necessarily good for the long term for gas to be so cheap in the United States. I've said before, gasoline prices in the United States are not accurate in the sense of representing the true cost of a gallon of gas, particularly including the environmental cost of a gallon of gas. When gas is more expensive, people tend to use less of it. And when you look at Europe, you see smaller vehicles and people being much more judicious in terms of their road trips. I've done road trips and done extensive driving in, let me think now, Spain, France, Italy, at minimum, if not other places as well. And with tiny vehicles, compact cars, little stick shift compact cars that I rent, it's stunning when I don't drive that much and the gas bill is 70 euro. And if in the United States gas prices were similar to those in Europe, which are arguably more accurate in representing the true cost of a gallon of gas, people would drive a lot less and we would be doing less damage to the environment. And so while by traditional economic standards, inflation down, gas prices down, stocks up, all of this stuff looks good for Biden, I also am painfully aware of the fact that higher gas prices encourage people to get off of gas-powered vehicles and move over to electrics, to drive less, to look for a more fuel-efficient vehicle. So these are all double-edged swords. But by the standard indicators we look at, things are looking really good. Doesn't mean there isn't poverty, inequality, lack of access to healthcare. Of course, we haven't solved the economy overnight, but many of the indicators Republicans themselves look at are looking very, very good. I have some incredible video to play for you of Texas gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke saying to a member in the audience who was laughing when he talked about gun violence, "It's not funny to me, mother effer." And I have to tell you, I love this. I've been saying these people on the right, the currency they trade in is ignorance, reactionary ideology, and humiliation, unfortunately. And Beto O'Rourke humiliated a Greg Abbott supporter who laughed out loud. Everybody heard it when Beto described the killing of 19 kids and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas. And Beto reacted in a way that is entirely appropriate given the circumstances. Take a look at this video going viral.
That now 11 weeks since we lost 19 kids and their two teachers shot to death with a weapon originally designed for use in combat, legally purchased by an 18-year-old who did not try to obtain one when he was 16 or 17, but followed the law that's on the books, ladies and gentlemen, that says that you can buy not one, you can buy two or more if you want to, AR-15s, hundreds of rounds of ammunition, and take that weapon that was originally designed for use on the battlefields in Vietnam to penetrate an enemy soldier's helmet at 500 feet and knock him down dead up against kids at 5 feet. It may be funny to you, motherfucker, but it's not funny to me, okay?
Oh, the tone, and he swore. Oh, well, when Trump swears, they love it. This is sort of the only appropriate reaction to someone laughing at a horrifying story of gun violence. Sometimes you got to speak their language. I mean, these are sick people. This is the currency they trade in. And reports from inside the event are that every single Abbott supporter in the room was laughing as if this were some kind of joke, what happened in Texas. I would love to see more Democrats just being able to speak out like this. It's genuine. This is Beto. And not cowering when these right-wing borderline domestic terrorists start behaving the way that they behave. Are deaths funny? Is gun violence funny? Funny how? What's funny about it? Now, this is a really important race in Texas. Beto O'Rourke is challenging the incumbent lunatic Republican Governor Greg Abbott. The polling is not tremendously great for Beto right now, but I think this one is very much worth fighting for. If you look at an average of recent polls, Abbott is ahead by just shy of 8 points right now. Abbott's got about half the vote. Beto's got about 42%. So this is, I mean, listen, let's not sugarcoat it. This is not the easiest margin to overcome, but it's certainly possible. And it would be absolutely extraordinary to be able to take this one from Republicans. So that's what's going on in Texas. Good for Beto, guys. This is the understandable frustration that we all should have with people who laugh at gun violence. They laugh and they want to do nothing about guns. Doors they'll talk about, windows, sinks, showers, and toilets they'll talk about, but not guns. We have a very interesting new development in the, for now, hypothetical 2024 Republican presidential matchup. Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump are essentially even right now in terms of the betting odds for 2024. Now, I want to remind everybody, this is not polling, okay? This is, you go to predictit.org and you can bet on who you believe will be the nominee. For the last many, many months, Donald Trump has been the clear, but increasingly by a smaller margin, favorite in terms of the betting odds to be the 2024 Republican nominee. Over the last 2 days after the FBI served a search warrant at Trump's home, Ron DeSantis actually pulled ahead. And then as of moments ago, in a virtual tie, Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis for 2024, in terms of not who will you vote for, but who will you bet on being the nominee? Right now, in order to win a dollar, you have to bet 37 cents on Donald Trump being the nominee. And in order to win a dollar, you have to bet 36 cents on DeSantis being the nominee. It is a virtual tie, and every reason to believe that this change is tied to the search warrant and the increasing legal problems for Trump. Trump pleading the fifth more than 400 times yesterday, which I will talk about in the next segment. In terms of polling, how does the polling actually look? It still favors Trump very clearly. New polls, we have a Yahoo News poll, YouGov Yahoo News poll from late July, early August, that has Trump plus 9. And then before that, at the end of July, a Harris-Harvard poll that has Trump plus like 30. Okay, so it is tightening, but also Donald Trump is still clearly the favorite among current Republican voters. We are going to be watching these numbers very closely. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it today, but we are certainly going to be keeping an eye on it. The numbers are tightening. And remember that DeSantis hasn't announced anything. Trump hasn't either, but Trump has been all but announcing, saying things like, we might have to do it again. I think you're going to be very happy with what we decide, et cetera, et cetera. It is not clear that Trump would necessarily win a contested Republican primary, which would be an extraordinary thing for a one-term president who lost. An unprecedented situation could be facing us in 2024, but we have 2022 coming up first, and so that's where our focus will be. Let me know your thoughts on where you see this Republican primary going. Find me on Twitter at DPacman. We will talk about pleading the fifth after this short break. Donald Trump pleaded the fifth over 400 times yesterday after previously saying only guilty people do it. Only the mob pleads the fifth. Hillary's staffers are clearly guilty because they pleaded the fifth. So let's back up and talk about what we are seeing here. Donald Trump yesterday was deposed by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Donald Trump did everything he could to avoid having to testify, to be deposed, to give a deposition in this investigation. This is an investigation into possible financial crimes by Donald Trump's business, including over and or undervaluing assets, depending on what he was trying to achieve, essentially keeping two sets of books, something you were not allowed to do. And as CNBC reports, Trump took Fifth Amendment more than 440 times in refusing to answer New York Attorney General Letitia James' questions. Donald Trump said he invoked his Fifth Amendment right to refuse to answer questions by investigators for New York Attorney General Letitia James. The scheduled deposition came days after the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago, Trump's home, as part of a criminal probe. James is investigating business practices of the Trump organization. Trump's adult children, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka, previously appeared for depositions in James's probe. As CNN also reports, Donald Trump declining to answer questions, stating that, quote, under the advice of my counsel and for all of the above reasons, I decline to answer the questions under the rights and privileges afforded to every citizen under the United States Constitution. And yet, Donald Trump had very strong views about the Fifth Amendment in the past. Take a listen to this.
The mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
Oh.
When you have your staff
right
taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth so they're not prosecuted. When you have the man that set up the illegal server taking the Fifth, I think it's disgraceful.
Have you seen what's going on in front of Congress? Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment. Horrible. Horrible.
It's like the— Yeah. Well, we know that there aren't really any principles. It's what can I say right now that's convenient and makes me look good? when years ago it was about this person took the fifth and that person took the fifth and you wanted to go after them, you say guilty people take the fifth. The mob takes the fifth. Innocent people don't do that. Now Trump takes the fifth, and his explanation is that he now gets it. He now understands why people take the fifth, because he's being railroaded and it's a witch hunt and on and on and on and on. They don't actually have any principles, whether it's on debt and deficit, whether it's on government overreach and authoritarianism, whether it's on business regulation. Oh, we're against regulation. Oh, Twitter doesn't like anti-vax disinformation. Well, now we want to regulate Twitter and force Twitter to have to publish anti-vax disinformation. There aren't actually any principles. And in a way, to you and me, this makes the movement seem pathetic. And it is. It makes the movement seem corrupt. It makes it seem vapid. And it is all of those things. But to other people, it doesn't matter. These right wingers don't care. They have the same priority as Trump, which is, what can I say today to make me look good? What can I say today? I try to get out of this on gas prices. I don't play the games. I don't play the games of, oh, well, the president is a great participant in reducing gas prices when it's a Democrat. And then I say something else when it's a Republican. I don't play those games. But these Republicans, the games is all they have left, unfortunately, because they've abandoned policy. And so, as I said earlier in the week, Herschel Walker, who doesn't want to debate his opponent, Raphael Warnock, he should just start saying, Warnock won't debate me. It's completely made up, but their followers will eat it up and they will repeat it. And Trump's followers, I saw some interviews with them outside Mar-a-Lago, they're already saying the same thing. Oh, he's being railroaded. Of course he should take the fifth. Oh, but what about all those times he said, no, it doesn't matter. Trump's being railroaded, and that's the bottom line. So by his own standard, only guilty people do what he did. Let's now talk about Trump's reaction to the deposition. Donald Trump came out hot from his deposition yesterday with New York Attorney General Letitia James. Trump pleaded the fifth more than 400 times, despite previously claiming only the mob and guilty people plead the fifth. And then he spent the day absolutely losing it on his platform, Truth Social. Take a look at what the president spent the afternoon doing. First of all, posting all sorts of different videos attacking Letitia James and attack videos of different kinds. Then saying at the very plush, beautiful and expensive attorney general's office, nice working conditions as people are being murdered all over New York. And she spends her time and effort on trying to get Trump. Trump then continuing and posting this entire statement about how Letitia James campaigned on getting Trump, and she's a racist, and she's hostile, and she's just determined to go after him. A multi-page tirade that makes absolutely no sense if you've been following the facts of the investigation. Trump then continuing about the raid, saying he participated and it was a surprise attack and it was all without warning or notification. Trump then saying, just leaving the attorney general's office, a very professional meeting, having a fantastic company with great assets, very little debt and lots of cash only in America. Even that doesn't appear to be true at this point about Donald Trump's businesses. Trump then posting a picture of a police car outside Mar-a-Lago with an article from the New York Post, posting that, in fact, multiple times, just spending his entire day posting all of this stuff. And he wants all of us to believe things that are simply unbelievable and not true. Trump wants us to believe that because he was participating in conversations with the FBI, that the search warrant must have been illegal or immoral. In fact, legal experts have pointed out, no. The fact that Trump was in contact with the FBI and they still issued a search warrant suggests that Trump was not actually providing to the FBI what he was supposed to provide. It's not better. It doesn't look better for Trump that the warrant was served after he was speaking to them. It actually looks worse. Donald Trump wants us to believe that him even being deposed by Letitia James is some horrible act of unfairness and injustice and whatever else the case may be. This is a guy who has spent 5 years using every legal mechanism he could think of to avoid releasing his taxes to anyone, including the House, including anybody, despite claiming as soon as his audits were over, he would release them, who has spent the time avoiding having to be deposed in sexual assault allegation cases, multiple of them, which I have told you about, trying to avoid providing all sorts of records to all sorts of different agencies, who has tried to avoid being deposed by Letitia James. On every single one of these, Donald Trump has gone above and beyond what any normal person would be allowed to get away with or could afford to get away with. And so with all the people who have now come out of the woodwork from the right saying, you know, we've got to be really worried, Trump's deposition, the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago, if it could happen to Trump, it could happen to any of us. It happens to all of us all the time. The two-tiered justice system is very clear, and we deal with this stuff all the time. It's the Trumps of the world that often don't have to deal with it. And it's absolutely stunning that now they are pulling all of this. So Donald Trump, clearly with much free time to just post and post and post to Truth Social. And the next question becomes, what is the next step? And I know that, you know, think about Matt Gaetz. We learned about the Matt Gaetz child sex traffic investigation in March of 2021. Nothing has really happened yet. These things can take a long time. And I know that there are many of you anxious to see, well, what's the next thing? What's Letitia James going to do? What's the DOJ going to do after the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago? Will it happen this week, next week, the next week after that? Maybe, but this stuff can take months, if not years. So my suggestion is, let's take it a day at a time. Right now, the focus really should be the 2022 midterms. We can't do anything about the timing of these investigations into Trump. We actually can do something in November, which is voting. And that means down ballot. And that means in every race available for you to vote in. That should be the focus. We will take a quick break. If you want to look at some of these clips and posts, find them on our Instagram at David Pakman Show. We're going to be back very, very soon. Today, we're going to be speaking with Catherine Judge, who's the Harvey J. Goldschmidt Professor of Law at Columbia Law School and also author of the book Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. Really great having you on. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I think intuitively, many in our audience will understand the concept of middlemen in the global economy. And my instinct is that at some point, it was quite logical to start seeing middlemen as we started to see many industries scale, international trade. You know, we could think of reasons why it made sense. What are the origins of so many middlemen in so many of the industries with which we regularly engage?
I mean, you really hit on a lot of the drivers. So the middlemen are the connectors through whom goods flow, through money flows, from people who have it to those who need it. And both as the economy got more global, but also as it got more specialized, we saw proliferation of middlemen helping to facilitate those transfers. So you might have, you know, investors with excess capital in one country and limited opportunities for return. And so you ended up initially with one, then in subsequently oftentimes layers of middlemen that would help facilitate flows to where there might be productive undertakings, even if that meant kind of going, moving the money abroad. Similarly, in production, we know games from trade is a classic idea. And of course, we've had a shift from just having goods imported from one country to another to really having globalized supply chains, where goods are made in a multi-continent undertaking, with each step kind of undertaking what it can do most efficiently. But of course, as you have that disaggregation of production, you need middlemen to help connect each step along the way.
So before we talk about some of the downsides, I mean, it seems accurate to say that in many cases, consumers do see lower prices on many products as a result of middlemen. Is that fair?
That's certainly fair. I mean, one of the points of the book is actually middlemen usually arise because they're really providing significant value. And it explores how overcoming the informational and logistical challenges that can otherwise impede transactions that make everybody better off is a real value-enhancing service to provide. So middlemen themselves are at this point really the backbone of the economy. They're not going to go anywhere soon. But what the book explores is that in a static environment, you can look at, take a snapshot, and it looks like they're providing a lot of value, and oftentimes they are. but the very nature of what makes them so good at their jobs also gives them the ability to exercise outsized influence on the evolution of the market and the evolution of the laws that are governing the spaces where they're active, that sometimes allows them to extract more value and lead to potentially other challenges in future periods.
So really, they, and when you say that, because if I think of like Walmart and Amazon are middlemen in a sense, in that they don't manufacture most of the products they sell. So in a sense, they've created this marketplace very convenient for all sorts of different products. But they also will contract with other middlemen in many cases as well. So they both are middlemen and also are not, depending on which relationship we're thinking of.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting points is when you look, the term middleman itself is very, it's easy to define in the abstract. But when you're trying to apply that to particular companies, part of what you realize is a lot of middlemen do provide additional value along the way. So their primary role might be helping to overcome informational or logistical challenges, but oftentimes they're doing other things in the process, right? And so the goal is to say, look, it's not going to ever be a clean line, but conceptually it's helpful to understand companies that are primarily engaged in this business of connecting, and Amazon and Walmart are among them. They certainly have other activities that they engage in. Amazon, with something like Amazon Web Services, is providing a completely different type of value proposition. But much of what they do is make it so American consumers can very readily access and have enough information to trust to buy goods that were made on the other side of the world. So there's efficiencies there and there's a real connection that's provided. But there's drawbacks.
One of the things that I think is a concern for many in my audience from the things we've talked about is the ways in which sometimes very large corporations will use middlemen and or contractors to avoid accountability in some cases, sometimes point the finger at some other entity. You know, the Amazon delivery services is one where often the vans that we all see driving around are not actually owned and operated by Amazon, even if they have Amazon painted. Sometimes it's local LLC delivery companies that own a bunch of vans, or, you know, there's different things. Is this one of the concerns with this infrastructure where you have all of these different parties?
It is one of the very significant concerns. So part of the challenge is, you know, if you're just going directly to the creator of a good, not only there's a relationship there, but there's clear accountability. And any information you want about that good, you can readily ascertain by asking the person or asking for representations and warranties, if you want to be legalistic, about the product, but also about the nature of how it was made and who was impacted. And part of what the book shows is that much of the complexity of today's supply chains and the structure of these layers of intermediaries grew up at a time where we just assume investors wanted to maximize the risk-adjusted returns and consumers wanted nothing more than the lowest price good, you know, holding quality constant according to some objective measures. But now we're in a world where people suddenly realize the government can't solve all of our problems. We actually care more about the impact of the goods on the planet, on the workers, and both through intentional use of middlemen to obfuscate, but also just a byproduct of really complex chains that were not necessarily designed to create opacity, but as a practical matter have created that opacity. It is now virtually impossible at times to understand. I mean, you can look at your breakfast cereal and trying to figure out where it all came from is oftentimes beyond the average consumer's capability. And so as we're bringing these additional values to the table, the accountability that people now want is oftentimes very difficult, if not impossible, to glob on top of the current system.
Yeah, I mean, in the kind of like hipster lefty space that I occupy, there's been a big move in the last 5 years to go towards, you know, craft and independent producers and products that are not as widely available. Sometimes that in and of itself is what makes them more interesting. And I do think that there is value to that because, you know, if you think about like the coffee roasting industry, instead of going to your grocery store and grabbing the, you know, Allegro that's available nationally or whatever, you find some local roaster and it's more interesting and you know who's roasting it. But it's almost always more expensive. And so it does seem that there is a very clear advantage, at least in the minds of consumers, to that. But there is certainly a price associated with it.
Yeah, and so I want to say a couple things on that. So first of all, I love the coffee roasting example. One of the examples in my books is Roost Roasters, which was a local coffee roaster, you know, and I knew them when they were small and they kept growing, but it is really nice. And one of the nice things about going direct is even though it's more expensive, you not only learn a lot, but you know where the money's going. So I actually feel a little better about the money I'm spending because I know the company, I know it's a local business, I know all of the people involved, I know how they treat their employees. So I actually feel better about the money I spent. And that is partly shifting from a world where we had long assumed scarcity to one where, as a practical matter, even though we still have a scarcity mindset because that's how we're taught to think so often, we really live in a world of abundance. So making more selective choices is oftentimes more rewarding, which is part of why you're seeing the trends you are. The final point I would make is, even though that's very often true, that right now direct is a little bit of a privileged good or seems like a privileged good.
Yep.
It's more pervasive than people realize outside of cities. So I get this question all the time from people who live in relatively urban environments. I live in an urban environment. But right now I'm out in our country. And part of what's been interesting since I published the book is I'm hearing from people in South Carolina, in Ohio, in all of these different states where they say, this is exactly what's already happening in my community. And actually they're keeping all of the value in their community and they're not necessarily paying as much of the premium because it's not the craft artisan that we think about in Brooklyn or kind of like a fun neighborhood as much as somebody who's really just like trying to make additional money by doing a product or a service on the side and maintains competitive by having good prices. It's not going to be as cheap as the mass-produced good in Walmart, partly because there you're exploiting kind of these incredibly low wage and worker protections in other places, but you really can, I think, hit a broader set of the value spectrum that many of us appreciate.
When it comes to supply chain and some of the issues that we saw early in the pandemic and then sort of again, and then even now to some degree, and we've seen, you know, baby formula and different things, it's not completely obvious to me as someone who does not share your level of expertise in this issue, whether the problem was made worse or was actually resolved more quickly by the kind of status quo of many middlemen in terms of supply chains and the way that products kind of get to the shelves and ultimately into people's homes. What is the relationship or the connection between those supply chain issues we've seen over the last 3 years and the existence of middlemen?
So I would say in terms of the risk, what we've seen arise, it really can be traced back to the proliferation of middlemen. But even though middlemen have, as you point out, I think accurately played a role in helping us to address the challenges, part of what the direct documents is the way middlemen proliferated slowly in number to become more layered in ways that really created these complex ecosystems. And generally speaking, nobody took a step back to look at the entire complex ecosystem. They were thinking we can eke a little more cost savings here, a little more efficiency there. And so they kept making decisions that incrementally were small, but in aggregate transformed the nature of the system. And then as we saw, once there were shifts, whether it's a spike in demand or limitations of supply because countries of origins, you know, were facing shutdowns, there were ripple effects that magnified that original distortion. Because you had all of these suddenly individual players that had depended on the system working well, having to figure out how to signal, you know, what they wanted, what they needed in ways where they were really looking out for themselves. And so you suddenly ended up with people wanting, like demanding for more than they actually needed because they were trying to hoard. And really the distortions kept getting bigger. And what's interesting for me is that this was actually one of the original motivations for the book. A lot of my original work was on financial regulation and looking at the way securitization chains that proliferated in the early aughts contributed to the 07 and 08 crisis. And we saw the exact same thing there, where we saw these chains that grew. So they were capital supply chains as opposed to good supply chains, but they grew incrementally over time. They appeared to make credit more available, so more people could buy homes. And that seemed like a really good thing at the time, because we could suddenly tap in to these new pools of capital in Germany and Japan to fund American homes. But we created an incredibly complex ecosystem where once things broke down a little, the dysfunction magnified, and nobody had the information they needed to help stabilize the functioning.
Yeah, it seems there's this interesting example I remember from early in the pandemic related to toilet paper, where, as you say, people started, wasn't that people were using more in total, but they were buying more, meaning they would be stocked up for a longer period of time. And it was shifting from being at work to being at home. And one of the questions a lot of people were asking was, well, all of the companies that deliver paper goods to businesses, shouldn't they just be able to redirect that and put it in grocery stores or at CVS or whatever the case may be? And part of the explanation was, well, we're talking about different packaging. These things are not packaged for sale in the same way. And that's done much earlier in the supply chain, often before it gets to the middlemen, the local company that you go to. Also, sometimes like the toilet paper rolls for businesses are gigantic, you know, and it just doesn't work at home. But also, the companies doing the servicing office buildings don't have any connection whatsoever to like CVS or Staples or whatever. So there were really a whole bunch of things that would have had to change. Now, would it have been simpler if the toilet paper manufacturers dealt directly with everyone? I don't know. That would have had its own share of problems.
Yeah, and part of the book is really not saying direct is the solution as much as direct is the cornerstone. And a cornerstone really is a very, very small piece of a much larger edifice. So the point is saying we've gotten to this hyper-intermediated world where, generally speaking, the instinct was always to add additional layers of middlemen. But as you nicely pointed out earlier, there's already a counter movement underway. There's already a number of people saying, to be able to really get what I want, to have my values match my actions, I need to opt out of the system entirely. And so by documenting both the growth of this hyper-intermediated world and this revolution, well, then we can figure out how to navigate this territory in between. And the toilet paper is a great example of it. So as you're pointing out, the nature of the supply chains had incredible rigidities, which just meant like they were used to doing one thing and they couldn't easily change.
Right.
And oftentimes what we're seeing with those rigidities, the complexity really accentuates them. And it's not about going direct, but having fewer middlemen and shorter chains can oftentimes enhance resilience and enhance flexibility. So it's trying to figure out where did we add layers over time without anybody really understanding, well, what are the states of the world where things might go wrong and where that might create problems, or going back to our earlier conversation, where there might be a lack of accountability because now there's just no way for us to actually see through all of the different layers involved.
There are some industries where there's been a move into a more direct model. One of the ones I think is interesting is, you know, for me, the experience of going to car dealers has never been good. I mean, it's not a pleasant experience, very low satisfaction with it for the average consumer. I ordered my last car online. It's a Tesla. I didn't have to talk to anybody. I picked the features I wanted. There was no negotiation. And then I got a call when the car was ready. And it was a dramatically better experience. Now, this is all aside from all the other concerns about Elon Musk's tweets, all these different things. I get that. But as an experience, the dealership is a terrible experience. And it seems to me that it would only make the end product more expensive. One report says, on average, people pay about $1,200 more for vehicles than they otherwise would because of the dealership experience. Another one that, as many real estate agents that I have in my social circle, that I think could be eliminated is the idea that a realtor regularly takes, you know, a slice out of every real estate transaction, can sell the same house multiple times. In many countries, you just deal with a lawyer and you don't need the entire infrastructure of the real estate agent. You could potentially cut out a middleman. Can you talk about either of those industries and or other industries that have done well at moving to a more direct model?
So both absolutely outstanding examples. I spent a lot of time on residential real estate and the car market fits equally well. And I'd actually done a huge amount of research and only left it out because I had so many other great examples.
Yeah.
So the great thing about your Tesla example is, yes, it was a better experience. And contrary to our earlier conversation, it was cheaper. You're cutting out an expensive middleman and you're saving real money. And same thing in residential real estate. We know for your average middle-class family, the median family in the United States, they don't have most of their money in stocks and bonds. Housing is our number one source of wealth. So when real estate agents come in and take 5% on average, even now, of every single real estate transaction, you are eating directly out of the bottom line, the nest egg of your typical middle-class family in a very meaningful way.
Now, so many of the real estate agents, in their defense, are also middle-class, right? I mean, there's two sides to that, to be fair.
Yeah, the hard thing with real estate agents is there's some really good research just showing that we have too many of them.
Mm.
So they provide very real value, but it's relatively easy to become a real estate agent. So what we've seen is there's some great work showing, you know, comparing, for example, Minneapolis and Boston and saying, look, when housing prices were about the same, each agent sold on average like 10 houses a year or 12 houses a year. And then suddenly the Boston housing market went crazy. So a decade later, what happened? Real estate agents in Minneapolis were still selling 10 to 12 houses a year. Real estate agents in Boston, their income was about the same, but they were suddenly selling on average 4 to 5 houses a year.
Mm.
And that's because the commissions went up because they were a percentage of sales. So many more people became real estate agents. And then so what do they all do? They send out like really glossy mailings to people who already own their homes, just saying like, choose me if you're going to sell. So it's not actually against the real estate agents themselves. It's a system that doesn't serve the agents and really doesn't serve homeowners.
Right.
And one nice thing about both the car market and the real estate market is they are examples where there have been state laws across numerous states that entrench the current system. So, for example, if you look at penetration of electric vehicle sales, one of the most significant indicators is do you have state laws that effectively entrench the need to use a car dealership.
Doesn't New Jersey have such a law?
Yeah, and I think so. I should double check. But a number of states do, and 10 states still have things protecting effectively prohibiting rebates. Because really, for real estate, it's the buy side more than the sell side, where a lot of countries have managed to get rid of the agent. So oftentimes sellers need a little more handholding, but you're also paying a lot to a buyer where they're doing their own work on Zillow or Redfin. But of course, what you're really tapping into there is the MLS, which is still controlled by full service real estate agents. And so those are both great examples where when you really look at the mechanisms, they are layered and a little complicated. But where you see people who came in originally and provided value, and then in a post-internet era, where there's so much more ability for consumers to do things for themselves, we should have had a change in the market structure. But the change has been relatively modest relative to the cost savings and the alternatives that open up. And it's partly because the entrenched middlemen really do a good job to undermine the alternatives that otherwise would be available, both through market mechanisms and through legal mechanisms.
Yeah, justifying their own existence, essentially. The book is Direct, The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. We've been speaking with the book's author, Catherine Judge, who teaches law at Columbia Law School. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Whenever there's a major scandal that rocks the political world, it sometimes takes a little while to figure out which talking points politicians are going to attach themselves to. And in the immediate aftermath of the FBI serving this search warrant on Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago earlier this week, we heard a bunch of different things floated from Republicans. We heard about this could be the start of an assassination attempt. That made no sense. There's no evidence of that. We heard about this as an abuse of power. We heard all sorts of different things, but the one that they seem to be sticking with is the FBI planted evidence. Now, the Trump people have not even released the search warrant, and it seems as though they're not going to. The latest reports I saw this morning are that they are not releasing the search warrant. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the FBI planted anything. There is also, it's sort of hard to believe that in a case this high profile, that is the approach that the FBI would take. If anything, my instinct is that the FBI would rather not have done this at all, because all of a sudden now Merrick Garland's getting death threats, Christopher Wray's getting death threats. It's crazy what is going on. I don't think that this is something they would do just for fun. But put that aside for a second. They are sticking with the FBI planted evidence. I had half a dozen examples for you of this over the last couple of days. And now people in greater and greater positions of power are starting to repeat this one. Here is Republican Senator Rand Paul, who is also floating without any evidence whatsoever that the FBI may be planting evidence. Take a listen to this. And it's seen as acceptable by many on the right for Rand Paul to make this claim, absent any reason to believe it's true.
No, people distrust so much the government that we've gotten to the point where For example, do I know that the boxes of material they took from Mar-a-Lago, that they won't put things in those boxes to entrap him? How do we know? Their lawyers weren't allowed to see the boxes go. They weren't categorized.
That's going to be a problem.
Thousands of documents were taken.
Yeah. Well, Rand, is there any reason to believe that such a thing was done? Because for everybody mentioning the planting of evidence, no one has been able to present any actual reason to believe that that happened.
How do we know that they're going to be honest with us about what's actually in the boxes? How do we know that was in the box before it left the residence if the lawyers weren't allowed to see everything? So, you know, they've lost a great deal of trust, and it's...
So there's Rand Paul asserting it. And this is sort of the anatomy of a conspiracy theory. It will often start sort of quietly as an aside with the most partisan people. Trump's lawyers, for example, going, listen, it wouldn't shock me if they even planted evidence. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And then people like Fox News hosts start latching onto it. And we played a number of examples of that from yesterday. And next thing you know, sitting senators and sitting members of Congress are doing the same thing. It almost seemed like Marjorie Taylor Greene got it from an OAN host. Here is Marjorie Taylor Greene yesterday nodding along as an OAN host says, maybe evidence was planted. And then I'll show you how later in the day she makes it her own.
And all of the documents and everything President Trump had at Mar-a-Lago, that isn't anything that the FBI needed to raid his home for. That is
no, we already ridiculous. Talked about that earlier. The GSA approved it. The GSA yes. approved yes. the documents, mailed them, sealed them, and sent them to him. So why would the government give them to him for now the government to come take them back?
That's completely untrue, by the way, but that's not the focus today.
Unless they're planting something. Anyway, I got to switch back because we're literally almost out of time, Merge. I knew this would happen because you and I are...
So Marjorie Taylor Greene saying about unless they plan to plant evidence, yeah, and right. And then later in the day, Marjorie Taylor Greene going full-fledged in on this, tweeting, quote, I think, now look at the language, right? I think, so that's your thinking, you don't have evidence. I think that there is an extremely high probability that the FBI planted evidence against President Trump. Otherwise, why would they not allow his attorneys or anyone watch them while they conducted their unprecedented raid? They know the consequences of an empty-handed power move. This rings completely and totally hollow. It just doesn't pass the sniff test. And let me also talk a little bit about Marjorie Taylor Greene's use of the word unprecedented. Yesterday, we talked about Marsha Blackburn's comment, if they can do this to Trump, they can do this to anyone, to which we said they already do it to anyone. The question is, will they ever do it to people in positions of power? The other one that Trump and others have been talking about is that this was an unprecedented raid. First of all, I've been guilty of this as well. The FBI doesn't really do raids. I mean, this wasn't really a raid. They had a search warrant and they served it. That's what it was. It was a search warrant. They executed a search warrant. So the use of raid, it's colloquially used and I do it as well. But understand that they served a search warrant. Unprecedented is a big focus for them. Trump said, no, this has never happened to any president before. And now a lot of these right wingers have latched on to the idea of unprecedented. Well, if it's never been done before, then it must be wrong. We've never had a president who did the things that Donald Trump did. So it's logical that, sort of like a mathematical equation. When you have unique inputs, you will have a unique output. And we're starting with a president who did things no other president has done. It's logical. It would be to be expected that the outcomes also are unlike those that we have seen before. And one such outcome is indeed a search warrant being served by the FBI on Donald Trump's home. There is no evidence that they planted evidence. If we ever learn that the FBI planted evidence, I will tell you that, and I will absolutely condemn it. For now, there's no reason to think that that took place. We are increasingly seeing reporting that the reason for all of this trouble at Mar-a-Lago is a traitor or a mole inside Donald Trump's circle. Now, there's a couple different elements to this. One is there a high-level traitor like Mark Meadows? Mark Meadows' name is one that is frequently mentioned. But then there's also a more nitty-gritty question of, like, is there just someone at Mar-a-Lago that has been involved in feeding information to the feds, about where things are being kept in Donald Trump's home or whatever the case may be. Increasingly seeing more and more reporting on this. Business Insider quoting Axios, Trump allies think there is a traitor in Mar-a-Lago who informed on him to the FBI. Allies of Trump believe an aide or aides to Trump may have flipped and provided evidence to the FBI about what he was keeping in his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, per Axios. When we look at the Axios report, one big thing Trump world suspects a flipper. Trump world is abuzz with speculation about which close aides or aide has flipped and provided additional sensitive information to the FBI about what Trump was keeping there. Trump's orbit is always an environment rife with mistrust and paranoia, and it has intensified. In a detail that seems too novelistic to be true, a focal point of the search was the Mar-a-Lago basement. Christina Bob, a lawyer for Trump, told the Washington Post his lawyers held discussions with the Justice Department this spring. Bob said Trump's legal team searched through two to three dozen boxes in a basement storage area, hunting for documents that could be considered presidential records. Bob told the Post that in June, Trump lawyers showed those boxes to investigators and they already looked through it. She said the investigators didn't think the storage unit was secured, so Trump officials added a lock. FBI agents broke through the lock during the search and then took a dozen boxes. Newsweek also exclusively reporting an informer told the FBI what documents Trump was hiding and where. The raid on Mar-a-Lago was based largely on information from an FBI confidential human source who was able to identify what classified documents Trump was still hiding in the locations. The officials who have direct knowledge of the FBI's deliberations were granted anonymity, said the raid of Trump's home was deliberately timed to occur when Trump was away. FBI decision makers in Washington and Miami thought that denying Trump a photo op or a platform from which to grandstand or try to thwart the raid would lower its profile. That failed. It prompted a furious response from Republican leaders. This is completely plausible. As with many of these things, we often, because of the documentation being not public, we often don't understand, and because of the need to protect informants, we often never learn everybody that is in touch with law enforcement in advance of such an action. But it would be completely reasonable to think that something like this took place. Marjorie Taylor Greene believes it, and she's on the case, and she wants the traitors found.
They do not want him in there, and they're so hell-bent on it. Guess what? We now know that there was an FBI informant at Mar-a-Lago, an FBI informant working at Mar-a-Lago.
By the way, she says she knows this based on media reports, the very same media she often decries as fake news that tells lies. Again, it's just what's convenient for us right now. Right now, it's convenient to believe those reports in the media.
Who is that? And how many other FBI informants are around President Trump on a daily basis, working at his clubs, working at Mar-a-Lago, or maybe Bedminster, or on his...
Bedminster. I know that's completely an aside. Bedminster. Bedminster. Please, Marjorie.
Staff. These are the things I want to know because they're traitors. They are traitors and they're helping the deep state and they're helping the people. These are the enemies within. These are the real enemies. And they are there to purposely create something against President Trump that is not there. It's absolutely not there. And everyone knows it. Everyone knows it. And if these people...
So traitor is the word that Marjorie Taylor Greene and quite frankly, many in MAGA world are using. Will we ever learn who it was? Probably not. But from a political standpoint, at a bigger picture level, Mark Meadows has never publicly accused Cassidy Hutchinson of lying during her testimony to the January 6th committee. And so... merely speculatively, it seems to me quite plausible that Meadows is somewhere involved in providing information to someone. Not could be FBI, could be January 6th committee. I don't know. But his silence when many others have said Cassidy is lying is very notable. That's probably separate from whatever so-called traitor was at Mar-a-Lago. Probably two different stories. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 219-2-DAVID-P. If you have anything to say, comment, question, concern, complaint, you can call 219-2-DAVID-P. You know, in the midst of all of these problems for the right, here's a caller reminding us about a very important story that no one's talking about anymore. Listen to this.
Dave, this is Chuck from Minneapolis.
Yes.
What about Obamagate? They could have raided the Obamas for that. If you forgot about Obamagate, you know what it is.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Yep. Whatever happened with Obamagate, you might remember that during Donald Trump's first and so far only presidential term, he started talking about Obamagate, which he described as the greatest political crime of the century. When he was asked, sir, what is Obamagate? He angrily told a reporter in the press briefing room, you know what it is. And no one knows what it is. But if there is anything ripe for a raid, I guess it would be this vague Obamagate. I don't know. We have a great bonus show for you today. In the midst of all of this economic good news and bad MAGA news, Joe Biden's approval rating has spiked to its highest point in 2 months. Things are really turning around for this guy. We're going to talk about it on the bonus show. We will also talk about a new report that says rainwater is not safe to drink because of the chemicals that are in it. And we will talk about the growing sort of, I hate to call it this, but it's kind of a pissing match between Apple and Samsung, or really iPhone and Android, where texting between the two platforms is increasingly broken. I'm going to explain to you what's going on and the behind the scenes of it. Very, very interesting corporate wars. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show.
Pac-Man's a loser.
Alex Jones hates the bonus show. I love the bonus show, and I would love for you to sign up at joinpacman.com. See you there today.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT, the inside from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My message to the Taliban is to reopen schools for girls as soon as possible. I urge them to keep their word, and I request the international community to pressure the Taliban to reopen our schools. We want to study.
As the Taliban cracks down on women's rights and millions of Afghans go hungry, we'll look at life in Afghanistan a year after the Taliban regained power. We'll speak to Matthew Akins of the New York Times about the Taliban's dangerous collision course with the West. Then, a jury in California has convicted a former worker at Twitter of spying for Saudi Arabia by providing the kingdom private information about Saudi dissidents. We'll speak to the sister of an imprisoned Saudi man who was tortured and jailed for running a satirical Twitter account.
My brother is a humanitarian aid worker who got kidnapped from his office more than 4 years ago and was placed under enforced disappearance, brutally tortured, and sentenced to 20 years of imprisonment for tweeting.
Plus, we speak to Walden Bello, the longtime Filipino activist and former vice presidential candidate. He was arrested Monday on cyber libel charges just weeks after the inauguration of the Philippines' new president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., son of the former U.S.-backed dictator. Bello says his arrest was masterminded by the Philippines' new vice president, Sara Duterte, the daughter of the former president, Rodrigo Duterte. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Merrick Garland asked a federal judge to unseal the warrant the FBI used in its August 8th search of former President Donald Trump's estate in Florida. Garland announced the request Thursday as he delivered his first public comment since Trump said the FBI had searched his Mar-a-Lago residence Monday.
The department filed the motion to make public the warrant and receipt in light of the former president's public confirmation of the search, the surrounding circumstances, and the substantial public interest in this matter.
Attorney General Garland said he personally approved the warrant and condemned verbal attacks on the FBI and Justice Department by Trump and his allies. The Washington Post reports the FBI is seeking, among other things, highly classified documents about U.S. nuclear weapons. Hours after Garland's remarks, Donald Trump said in a statement he encouraged the immediate unsealing of the warrant. If Trump is proven to have mishandled classified documents, he could be guilty of a felony. In 2018, then-President Trump signed a bill upgrading the crime from a misdemeanor to a felony while increasing punishments for those who mishandle classified information. In Ohio, a man wearing body armor and armed with an AR-15-style assault rifle fired a nail gun into an FBI field office in Cincinnati Thursday, prompting a gun battle, chase, and armed standoff that ended hours later when the gunman was shot dead by police in a cornfield. Officials identified the man as 42-year-old Ricky Schiffer, a supporter of Donald Trump and the far-right Proud Boys. 2 days before Thursday's attack on the FBI, Schiffer posted on Trump's Truth Social online forum, calling on allies to, quote, kill the FBI on site, unquote. Schiffer also appears in a video posted to Facebook on January 5, 2021, showing him at a pro-Trump rally in Washington, D.C. the night before the assault on the Capitol, and he boasted online he was at the insurrection. The FBI's execution of a search warrant on Mar-a-Lago